everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as audio and video interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA by going to pnwa.org. Well, when I interviewed my my today's guest, novelist Heather Barbieri, she described her childhood where, as a young girl, she was given lots of free time to sort of, a lot of free unscheduled time that she used to, as she described it, get into a certain amount of trouble, but also which she used to sort of roam about in her imagination, which I think is a very good beginning for a budding writer, because we all need that, don't we? We all need time to roam, and it's a skill, in a way, we have to harness. And she did. She harnessed it into three novels now, a budding writing career, and she is on the show with me today, and she will hopefully roam right alongside me. Heather, welcome to Author.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here.
So before we get in, it's been since May that the house, the cottage at Glass Beach, your third novel, was released, and it's still on the shelves. Is that correct?
That's right.
As we speak now, and this takes us, again, we have in the cottage at Glass Beach a visitor to a small community. I believe in The Lacemakers of Glenmar, we had a traveler arrive at a small village in Ireland, wasn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
And now we have a small community off the Massachusetts coast.
Coast of Maine, that's
coast
right.
Coast of Maine, excuse me, yeah. So are you drawn to the small communities, or did you find something in The Lacemakers of Glenmar that you wanted to visit again? How did you come back to that same sort of theme?
Well, I think part of it is that I grew up in a relatively small town, Olympia, and also the fact that I would visit my father's relatively small town, Butte, Montana, in the summer, so that's kind of part of my background. But in terms of The Lacemakers of Glenmara, you had a young woman traveling to a completely new place. She was trying to just sort of lose herself in part of Europe, as can be the case with young people. But in the case of the current book, you have a woman who actually has a history in this small town. She was actually born there on the island and left at a very young age. And that whole early part of her childhood is shrouded in mystery. So she ends up returning there to figure out, sort of have a greater sense of what her past means, and then also to escape her present, which is a difficult marriage.
You know, it's so different writing about a small town as opposed to sticking something in a city, because when you're dealing with a city, it seems to me you're writing about just the whole presence of the city, and there's a kind of anonymity to it, of course. But when you're writing about the small town, you're really getting into just a giant extended family, or at least you can.
That's
all those
true.
Relationships all seem to affect conceivably the whole town in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. I'm always fascinated by character. That's kind of where my work starts, is where I'll go for walks or be out on a run, and often I will hear lines of dialogue. That's kind of where it begins for me. So perhaps that's in part why I'm drawn to small towns for that reason. But I think even in the larger communities of a city, while there is sort of that sense of anonymity, even within that, we find our own little communities.
Oh, absolutely. There's usually small towns in every big city, aren't there,
exactly,
that we all are drawn to. But there's something about the boundaries of a small city. But, you know, you'd said this to me during when I spoke back in 2010, when you released The Lacemakers of Glenmar. I think it may have been the paperback of that. But and you mentioned that you hear these snippets of dialogue when you're out on a walk or a run or taking a shower or whatever. And I was curious, do you... So if you're starting a new book, does it, you begin with a character, and that character begins usually with some, you're hearing their voice talking to you. How does that start?
Oh, boy. You know, I'm trying to figure that out. Someone asked me a question. This is something that I think a lot of writers get. People ask, you know, well, this is your, now I'm at work on my fourth book. This is your fourth book. Does it get easier? You know, in other words, do the characters show up? You know, and I wish I could say yes. I think,
right.
I don't know if it's easier if you write more to a formula or, you know, if you're a genre writer. I can't really speak to that. I'm guessing still it can be difficult. But, you know, in this case, you know, the one I'm working on now, it's actually set in a city. It's set in Seattle, so that will be kind of interesting to see how that compares to, you know, the small town setting, I guess. But, you know, typically there is a character who shows up, but then, you know, the other aspect of my work is that it's also very much based on setting and place. So, you know, there's a strong sense of whatever the setting or the place is, it's almost like another character in the book. So, right now, what I tend to do is I'll read around a little bit. I won't read anything new necessarily, but I'll kind of go back to some things that I've read and see if they'll spark my imagination. You know, kind of unlock that little key that's sort of in your subconscious.
You read fiction?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, I do, but not necessarily anything new. You know, I kind of have touchstones for each book. The first book, not so much. With Lacemakers, was there one for Lacemakers? Light Years by James Salter, which had absolutely nothing to do with the book at all. But, you know, his writing is so lush and beautiful that it kind of got my mind going.
Yeah, I always think that, but isn't that kind of almost like you're looking for like a feeling? A kind of an impulse, just an energy that you're going to work with.
Well, or just being inspired by the beauty of language. That's often what happens because I can, you know, whatever it is, it's kind of unlocking that key at the time. I can't claim any relation to it. All I can claim is admiration for the work, and that's kind of where it starts. With The Cottage at Glass Beach, it was The Last September by Elizabeth Bowen, and then Light Years again. And then with the current one, a little bit of the first section of Atonement, and then a little Olive Kitteridge, and then probably will be James Salter again just because, you know, he's a poet and an author and just incredible. But we'll see.
That's interesting. So you turn to authors and you use their work again and again just to sort of get the blood, just get that language storytelling blood flowing for you.
And then I find that being at the computer is too constricting at that point. I was waiting for the current book to sort of kick in. You know, not the current one I'm writing, I should clarify, The Cottage at Glass Beach to come out.
Right.
You know, you submit it, it gets approved, it goes into production, and then there's that little gap when promotion kicks in. And you're twiddling your thumbs a bit, and I'm pretty even-keeled, so I don't let it get in my head too much, but I'll be honest, you know, it gets in everybody's head. So in order to get around that, I started writing again, and I was writing at the computer, which was fine for then, but now I find that I have to be, you know, reading certain things and then writing longhand in a journal. And it's not pages and pages, it's just snippets of things at this point that, you know, may or may not be used.
And so you let yourself sit down at a piece of legal paper or whatever and just let whatever wants to come out, come out.
Mm-hmm.
And is it ever like a little scene? Are your characters talking?
Oh, yeah.
Are you describing?
Oh, yeah,
setting?
Definitely. They're talking, and, you know, it's fascinating. You will read something that someone else has written that's wonderful, and you will write something that has absolutely nothing to do with it other than the fact that it's just sort of, as you said, gotten your blood flowing a little bit. So it's interesting to me. It's complicated by the fact that my handwriting is really bad. So sometimes I'll go back and look at it.
Amen, sister. I can't. If I'm ever enshrined in some literary hall, they're going to be cursing the day that I ever wrote a thing on paper because no one will know what I ever had to say.
It's terrible. No one believes me. When I was in elementary school, I had beautiful handwriting and I won awards for it. Now there's this ongoing argument of who has the worst handwriting in the family, me or my dad, who's a retired judge. And unfortunately, people are saying now it's me.
Oh, it's, you know, it's
I'm not sure that's the battle I want to win.
Well, but, you know, it's so interesting, the relationship we have with our imagination. And it really is a relationship with almost like another person, because whenever I listen to writers who do creative work talking about their writing, they are describing a relationship with something sort of outside of them, that they have to learn its language and how best to speak to it. Because, I mean, what you're describing to me is not something that you are in control of in the classic sense of like, okay, we can have dinner at 6 o'clock, I can control that kind of thing.
Well, you know what's interesting is I think the old journalist in me almost works better on deadlines. So if I don't have a specific deadline, then I'll mill about for quite a while. I can find other things to do, you know, take some art classes, you know, whatever it is, do some other things that are of interest. But, you know, for example, with the cottage at Glass Beach, there was a lot of milling about that happened before I really got going on that. But then I got a book deal on a partial, which I'd never had before. You know, so that was sort of an interesting thing, getting a book deal on something that basically didn't exist yet, except for a couple chapters.
Right.
And then, you know, the thing with that was, it's like, okay, you have your book deal in April, but we'd really like to see this by September. And the reason they said that is because they know once I'm in the zone, I can write quickly.
Oh, they've learned that about you now?
They have, which is good and bad. You know, I mean, it's good in some ways, but although there's a part of me that would like to, you know, take a little more time. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, it's not really how I operate. But you know, I suppose it was gestating in the back of my mind, perhaps. But so I was given this deal, and part of what happened, though, between having to write the outline, which I'd never written an outline before either.
Did they want you to write an outline?
Yeah, and outlines for me usually don't happen until later.
Right.
You know, I'll kind of, and so I did it very begrudgingly, and it was good for me. But it changed because right around when I was given the deal, my mom passed away suddenly.
Oh, sorry.
And
to hear
so what happens is, what I discovered is that the creative process, the subconscious, and the grieving process are all tied very closely together. And so the book changed based on what I was going through at that time. And it wasn't all a negative. You know, it's all a process of life and everything. But that informed the book. And on top of that, the kids were all home from school. The kids are all older, mind you. But they were home from college and high school and all that. And surprisingly, they interrupt just as much as when they were two.
Isn't that great?
Which is, you know, it's good. It's good. I'm glad they do. It's much better than them just
shutting you out. Do their interruptions somehow influence the book somehow, just their little appearances energetically?
You know, although sometimes things, little things they say will get into my books.
Yeah.
And they'll just say, oh, I can't believe, you know, little, when they misspeak or little arguments, you know, things from the past. And they'll just say, I can't believe you put that in there. It's like, come on, it was really good, you know.
You know, it's funny.
Can't help it.
These editors ask for, they don't ask it from everybody, outlines, but have they not learned? I mean, obviously your book changed from the outline, and they probably didn't even remember what's in the outline, or did they?
Well, no, I mean, you know, I think part of it is that, you know, with the editorial process and the marketing process are very interconnected sometimes, or at least ultimately in the end they are. So people need to have something to look at, to have a sense of where they think you might be going, so
they can start
having a sense of how they might, package you. I think that's probably more what it's about than anything. But, you know, that's just me sort of spinning my wheels about that. But anyway, so everybody was home, and I basically spent a couple hours a day writing in a very focused manner. It doesn't matter if I can spend 8 hours in a day, and I won't have really anything more to show than if I wrote for one or two in an extremely focused way.
I am exactly the same way. I would rather write, and sometimes I usually only allot myself 2 to 2.5 hours if I'm working on a book. And sometimes, because of the way I work, for that first hour, I will write almost nothing. I'll sit there and be going, and then kapow, in the last hour, whatever's been sitting there, I might get 4 pages, you know, in
right.
the last hour.
And, you know, you have, that's your period of time to get it done.
Yeah.
And you know, and plus, you know, honestly, even if I didn't have that pressure, I want to do other stuff. So,
yeah.
You know,
I can't be creative. I don't think I could be creative on that level for 8 hours a day.
I think it just depends.
Would get dry out or something.
I think everybody's different. However, if I'm in more of a kind of editing and polishing phase, then I can stay at the desk longer. That calls on something different. You know, it just kind of calls on, you know, detailed focus and endurance for getting kind of that type of thing done. So in other words, you know, it happened very quickly and in a very focused way because I had a specific deadline, which I thought, you know, in the beginning I thought, geez, I don't know if I can do this. You know, this you know, big loss happened, trying to support my, you know, anyway, there's all this stuff going on. But, you know, I didn't want to say that I couldn't because I already said that
no.
I could.
Yeah.
And it worked out fine.
It's so funny. It reminds me when I interviewed Lev Grossman, who wrote he had written like a literary suspense novel. He's a book reviewer for Time, and his father was like this big deal poet, and very literary household. But he decided to finally write YA fantasy. He wrote The Magicians, which was like, I think William Gibson called it Harry Potter with sex and drugs. You know, so he wrote The Magicians. It took him 5 years to write it, though, but big-time bestseller, blah, blah, blah. And they say, great, we want a Magicians too, which he hadn't planned, but he said, okay, fine. So he set to work, and they said, well, how's it coming? He said, well, it's coming. They said, well, it's due in 9 months. And he said, well, I know, I don't know if I can get it done in a month. They said, you don't understand. A printer is scheduled to print your book on X date. We will need it. You must finish it in 9 months. And so he had been, up to that point, he had worked very leisurely. And then suddenly he found himself under this deadline like he had never had before. And to his surprise, he wrote just as easily and just as fluidly, and he felt just as effectively once he no longer could take his time even. That in the end,
right.
that time that they put on him was not what he would have imagined before, back when he had no deadline. He thought there was no way he could work under that kind of pressure. Well, lo and behold, he actually could. I'm not sure it's true of everybody, but I think there's a lot of writers who can work quicker than they understand that they can.
Right, and you know, in these days too, they would like to have people to have a book out every year or two. You know, that's kind of what
of
they
course.
Would prefer. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of shooting for
literary
that.
Literary writers don't tend to go out every. I mean, you're considered literary fiction or mainstream.
Yeah.
I don't know what
you but, you know, they would still like that. You know, they said, how about every two?
Yeah. Well, sure. Well, you'd probably like to have a book out every 2 years if you could do it.
Yeah, you know, I think so. And I think, you know, I'm getting to that point. I keep making excuses. Part of it was I was on tour all summer. And I was, you know, thinking I could write and be on tour, but that's just really not possible for me. You know, you're in a specific zone when you're on tour and promoting your book. And I love that because you're out and about, you're meeting people and you're supporting booksellers. I do, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be a little bit of a grind at times. But, you know, there's nothing that really compares for both readers and writers to have that opportunity to make a personal connection with people. And, you know, it's not a connection on Facebook or, you know, Internet. I mean, those are great, too. But having that face-to-face personal contact is pretty special.
You know, I think is good about it is this, is when you're writing, I mean, first you're locked all by yourself in your little, you know, cave when you're writing your book, right? And that's very solitary. You're just sitting there trying to write the story or whatever.
Right.
And then it's, you know, you're human and you're an adult and you have bills to pay and you have a ego and you have all these other horrible things that think about money and think about how many books you sell and maybe you compare yourself to other, and all you have all these thoughts about how well the book is doing and marketing and promotion, blah, 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 blah. But then when you get to actually meet someone who's read it and just who hopefully will say to you, oh, I read it and I loved it and it meant X, Y, and Z to me. It reconnects you to the experience that you're writing this for other human beings to have a moving, compelling experience and not just to keep the career train chugging. You understand what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
It's so true. You know, I had, I would say, well, there were a lot of good experiences with the cottage at Glass Beach when I was out and about, but I recently had this letter forwarded to me from my publisher, and it was actually sent, geez, I don't know, last January, so earlier this year.
Yeah.
And it was from an 89-year-old man in assisted living in Nashville, Tennessee, retired newspaperman who had read The Lacemakers of Glanmara, and he was so excited about it. And, you know, said it moved him to tears, and, you know, and he loves PBS and Masterpiece Theater and everything, just like I do.
Right.
And, you know, just to see this, you know, this handwritten letter that someone had taken the time to write was just so sweet. You know, I showed a few people the letter, and everybody's just like, oh, wow, you know. And I don't want to say that, you know, I don't really write for the attention. It's nice to get it. You know, you need the book to do well, at least so that you can keep getting more books published.
Right.
Now, I have someone who pays the bills here, fortunately, more than I do. I mean, I'm actually helping pay the bills now, which is great, but I can't claim to have always done that. And I don't, you know, I don't look at reviews anymore. I don't.
Good for you.
With the first and even the second book, I would do that. And then I just thought, you know what, it makes no difference. And even though really the vast majority of them are really quite good or even okay, you know, they're the ones who are not that great or not that many, but those
you
are
will
the ones
remember
in
the
your
bad
head.
Ones.
Oh, they get in your head. And
that's
so I
right.
just thought, you know what, you are not looking. You're not going to look.
Yep.
And I haven't.
And in fact, you know, I would take that one step further. And I know this is extreme, but I would think writers, although I publish them in my magazine, and I know writers, some writers make a living writing them, but I think novelists are best served not to read any book reviews of any books. Only because
that's interesting.
It instigates the vibration of comparison and of outside-in thinking about what do people think of it. And it's death. It's death. You know, I don't think there's any... I mean, I know that you want... that some writers can use it as fuel, like, you know, oh, that was a bad review, that's going to compel me to write a better book the next time. But if you sit at that computer and you are thinking for 1 minute about what other people think of it, you're screwed because they're not there.
Right.
So what are you thinking about at that point, really? It's not your book. So,
no.
Well, good for you. Good for you. You don't read reviews.
Well, you know, a friend of mine, you know, quite some time ago said that she didn't read them. And I just said, wow. And I thought, wow, how do you do that? And I couldn't, you know, at first book, you're just so excited.
Yeah, you want to see.
You're so naive. You just really have no idea, and you know, about anything. That's one of the things of this process that has been interesting to me is just how the business works and how it's changing.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
it's sort of like having, you know, having this really interesting, complex relative who, you know, it would be even more interesting if they weren't related to you exactly.
Right.
But,
well,
but
it is,
you know,
changing, and everybody's nervous. And
the
publishing world for an entertainment industry, which is essentially what it is mm-hmm. the most old-fashioned of all the, you know, music, film, maybe theater is more old-fashioned, I guess, because I don't know what they can do with the digital revolution.
Well, that's true. That's a good
there's
point.
There's really nothing to be done. But, they're pretty kind of, you know, very traditional, and it's changing now whether they want it to or not, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can see it. And so, all right, so now the fourth book, which you're working on, this is not done, though, yet, is it?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I mean, I had about 120 pages that I'd written on it before The Cottage at Glass Beach came out.
Oh, good.
And, you know, and then I went back and I started looking at it again. Oh, I don't know. You know, I mean, parts of it are fine, but then, you know, so then I started going back and then I reworking it and pretty happy with some of that. And then I just totally backed off and, you know, started scribbling longhand to just kind of see if I could really, I didn't feel like I was quite sinking into the material the way I was wanting to. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. And my excuse is that the holidays are coming, so I'm still kind of, you know, dabbling.
Yeah, that's a good excuse. Just hang on to that one. All right. All right. So, Heather, before, I don't want to run out of time without asking you this question. I didn't get to ask you this back when I interviewed you the first time because I wasn't asking it then. But so finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
To stay humble and positive.
Humble. Another humble one. That's good. Good answer. And
because
positive.
You say, you know, you say that it there's so much ego involved, but you're better off if you can limit that.
Absolutely. Oh, no, it's absolutely true. Because as soon as you start taking, even as soon as you start taking credit in a weird way for your books, because like I said, you're in a relationship and there's a part of you that you're like listening to. Don't you think that part of you?
Yeah, it's just, you know, the way I describe it is just, you know, I just do what I do.
Right.
You know, other people, their career is, you know, as an accountant or as a doctor or, you know, this is what I do.
Right.
Or one of the things that I do. So, you know, it's not like it's that vaunted of a career, you know, really. And it's an apprenticeship. You keep trying to improve. And I think it's true with life in general. You try to, you know, learn and become a better person and grow as an author, as a human being. That same kind of sort of more humanistic approach, I guess, to the career is something that kind of works for me.
Humble and positive. And positive.
Yes.
I like that.
Well, you've got it, because there's a lot of there can be a lot of negativity.
Great temptation.
Mm-hmm.
Pessimistic. If you get a group of writers all together, it is very easy for it to descend into this sort of complaint.
Oh,
sure. It's
almost
putting a gun to everyone's head to make them do this.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's important to have the support, and it's important to be able to vent. You know, seriously, but it's even better if you can, you know, stop those thoughts before they even take on that kind of energy.
I agree.
It's possible. You know, we all have choices. We can, you know, really start retraining the way we sort of approach things, including our writing or whatever else. So that's what I'm working on.
Oh, I think it's great. I decided when I started Author, I didn't want to create another sort of writing magazine that focused on the business and craft. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I just felt there was a lot of information out there on those two topics. But I felt that I wanted to create a voice, really, of positive energy around the publishing, because what I would run into again and again is all kinds of, well, it's really hard, and you gotta, and there's gonna be rejection, and there's gonna be, you know, and it's gonna take X number of years, and this is the percentages, and on and on and on and on. And I felt that maybe that was true, maybe it wasn't, but I didn't actually see how it helped. I felt if you wanted to do it, you're going to do it, and you might as well stay optimistic, because you know how it is with writing. If you're going to be a writer, you're going to write anyway. There's really no way around it.
Yeah, and you know, things take work, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, it takes work. It, you know, writing's not the only thing that can be hard. There are a lot of things that can be hard. And, you need to put in the work, realize that that has to happen, realize that you don't have complete control over the outcome after you put it out there. And let things serve their purpose and learn from it. You know, it's not that you can't, you know, learn about the business, learn about yourself and your writing or whatever, and then keep going. You know, you don't give up either. At the same time, you're staying positive. That's one of the things that allows you to not give up either.
What a perfect note on which to end our show. Heather, thank you so much for coming
on
Author to Author.
It was great to talk to you, Bill. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, listen, have a good holiday season, and I'm sure I'll see you around. And to everybody else, make sure you join me next week. My guest can be the one and only Garth Stein, author of The Art of Racing in the Rain. Until then, well, just like Heather said, stay positive, stay humble, and write what you love, really and honestly.